July 2nd, 2020. This is No Filter Sports. Eli Zarrett, Danny McLean, Bob Page reporting, as Howard Cosell used to say. We're going to hear from Howard Cosell on the show, by the way, when he introduces, not introduces.
You'll hear from me when I feel like.
That's right. And he's going to be when he is describing the championship effort of our guest today, Hilmer Kenty, who was Detroit's first champion since Joe Louis. Back in 1980, he won the title with Joe Louis in the audience. An incredible day in Detroit sports. And, you know, think about it, Bob, back in the 70s when we were both on radio. And one day we're at the sports, the Detroit Sports Broadcast Association thing, and Emmanuel Stewart, who we didn't know, he was an electrician working for Detroit Edison. He's there with this tall, skinny black kid named Thomas Hearns, who was petrified, didn't even talk. And a little white guy named Mickey Goodwin, who had some personality but couldn't fight. And I say that kind of, that's nasty to say that, but Mickey was not nearly the talent, but he was the he was the white guy that kind of gave a little more exposure to bring boxing back. And I remember saying, boxing? We don't do boxing in Detroit. Are you kidding me? These two kids are gonna revitalize boxing. And everything Emmanuel said that day turned out to be, and it's if you had said that day in 77, he's gonna manage train 41 champions out of this beat up little gym, you know, where they eventually, you know, stole all the copper from it and burned it down years later.
And Eli, he came to us. He came to you and he came to me. He said, Eli, I said, Bob, give me a break. Can you do an interview with Thomas or Hilmer? Can you give him some airtime? Can you please put him on the air? Give us some publicity. We said, sure, Emmanuel, you're a good guy. We like you. Of course, we're going to do that.
Yeah,
you're the big boxing guy. You grew up a huge fan. I didn't.
Well, I was
a boxing fan, so I learned an awful lot, you know, covering Kronk as I did all those years.
I did a number of shows with Tommy, and of course, Emmanuel, once in a while, he'd show up for some of the shows. And, you know, I'm not a great big monster boxing fan, but I loved sitting next to Tommy or Emmanuel when they started telling their boxing stories about this guy, that guy, who shoved him into the ring, who shoved him into the corner, bouncing off the ring, bouncing off the ropes. I mean, it was unbelievable the way these guys talk about who they fought, when they fought, and what the conclusions to most of these fights.
Yeah, you know,
the hitman's got a, which is a little unusual for me, for people to hear this, but the hitman's got a hell of a personality if you can just get him a little loose.
Yeah, if you can get him a little loose.
He was never articulate then. The years of pounding in the ring have taken its toll. People ask us all the time, how come Tommy Hearns hasn't been on the show? Believe me, Eli and I have been working behind the scenes. We've been talking to people, and apparently, it just can't be done. Okay.
Yeah.
That's all
I'll
say.
If we had him alive in the studio, there might be a chance. But in any case, you know, they were also, Emmanuel's helped a little bit, and we'll talk about this with Hilmer later, that boxing back then, and maybe Cosell was one of the reasons, was on network television. Yep. And when Hilmer won,
I made the sport of boxing. Are you kidding me?
When he won, it was on national TV. Now, there were some big fights that, you know, when Hearns, Hagler, and all that are on closed circuit TV. But back then, they had regular weekly sports shows around boxing on the major networks. And with Duran and Sugar Ray and the 76 Olympic team with Sugar Ray and those guys and the Sphinxes became. It was a big sport in America for a while. And now,
all right, Eli,
back.
Go ahead. I'm a big boy. I can take it. You've told it a million times, but I don't think you've ever told it on the show before. Go ahead and tell the listeners the Chuck Davy story.
I think I did tell that, but I'll
did you tell you that did. Story. Go
you
ahead.
Did.
He did. Okay. Apparently I pissed Chuck off, who was Brandon isn't. Go ahead, Eli. What was the story?
It's just your arrogance. Chuck Davy was a welterweight in the 40s and I think the 50s. Never won the title.
Out of Michigan State.
And let me, before you continue, one of the great gentlemen you'd ever meet in your life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yes.
He was a gentleman to the nth degree.
And so at this Sports Broadcasters Club, the same one where Emmanuel brought the guys, probably maybe a year later than that. I don't know. This was in the mid-70s. And Chuck Davy, you know, would come to the Broadcasters Club. He would talk to people. He would give updates on boxing, even though there really wasn't much going on. And, yeah, really gentle, wonderful man. And one day he's entertaining five or six people in a little circle. And Bob, typical Bob, puts his head in and says, he goes, oh, Chuck, you know boxing's a bunch of BS. And I love
that's not the way it went. You're lying. Calm down.
And what did you say?
I didn't say go ahead and rip me a new one, Eli. That's not what happened.
What did you say?
I was interviewing Chuck, I think, and I said, Chuck, you know, does anybody really, you know, care about boxing anymore? So I think I was more circumspect.
No, you go, Chuck, more tactful. He goes, that. Chuck, you know, it's a bunch of BS.
And
he,
it's a better story this way.
Well, it's the truth. The look on his face, and we're all like a little embarrassed. Oh, my goodness. But anyway, that's just and before we get into baseball, which is actually going to start today, I do want to say I have a little update. You know, it was on this day. Yesterday, July 1st.
Yep.
50 years ago, Denny returns from his suspension to pitch at Tiger Stadium against the Yankees. He lost 6-5, and it's amazing he could even throw the ball at all because they gave you no spring training. You're down in Lakeland after being suspended for half a year for gambling, allegedly. And I think you probably hurt your arm again that year, whatever. But here's the story that I want to update. You're right, Bob. The stadium was packed. It was a World Series field, 53,000 people to see Denny return. Don't forget, he had won the Cy Young the last two seasons, 68 and 69. They suspended the Cy Young winner, allegedly for consorting with the mob, Vito Giacalone. Well, here's your update. I'm golfing in Ann Arbor on Tuesday, and I'm golfing with a guy who was the grandson of a very famous Tiger whose name I'm not going to give you. Turns out he was processed in jail in the early 80s, the same day as Vito Giacalone. And he was being processed with Giacalone, and he said, what's the story? You allegedly stomped on Denny McClain's foot on the boat in somewhere docked in Detroit that made the cover of Sports Illustrated, just sent to Brandon, February 23rd, 1970, Denny McClain and the mob, baseball's big scandal. And Giacalone laughed at him and said, never happened, a bunch of garbage. Now, Denny has always said that he tripped and hurt his foot or somehow
in the clubhouse. Tripped over the dog, I think, in is the what clubhouse. It was the last time.
In the clubhouse.
Oh, the clubhouse now.
That's,
okay.
I started it in the clubhouse and wound up tripping in my garage because of my dog at 2 o'clock in the morning and watching the television show. This is a great part of the story. And the television that went off at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning was The Untouchables.
anyway, so.
Well, you know, so Eli.
Can't make it up.
Through my connections with my young wife's well-to-do family on that fateful night, we had reserve seat tickets up behind, fairly good distance behind, the third base dugout to see my teenage hero, Denny McClain, come back. I will never forget when Denny walked out of the Tigers dugout before the game to take the mound. 50,000 flash bulbs popping everywhere. His hair looked like this weird blonde Beach Boy color, and we were just standing and cheering for our idol Denny McClain, and my umpiring idol of all time, Nestor Shylock, had the dish that night. I can still see Denny throwing his first pitch, more flash bulbs everywhere. It was a curveball that was high. Nestor called it a ball. Denny, take it from there. What was that night like for you?
Well, it was a great night, and I'd warmed up down the third baseline that night for some reason. They had crews out there, so there wasn't any room to warm up near the – remember, they used to warm up right near home plate by the dugout. So when it was all over with, Hal Naragon, who had caught me to warm up, he said, all right, let's go. And so we started walking down to the third base dugout, and all of a sudden, people started standing up all over the ballpark. I said, Hal, who do you think is here? Are you kidding? President here? The mayor? Who's here? He said, Denny. And you know, Hal had a little lisp in the way he talked. He, Denny, that's for you. That is for you. I said, for what?
Come on, Denny. No, surely.
I said, listen, I'm so happy to be back. It's unbelievable. And I said, I don't know what's going to happen tonight, but we'll have a couple of laughs before it's all over with. So, you know, you just walked out to the mound, you got ready. Billy caught a good ball game for a while. And then I think he started telling people what was coming because they were hitting the ball all over the damn place. As far as the Giacalone thing, let me clear that up one time forever, okay? And by the way, we got a book out that explains this, Eli and I do. And when I was interviewed, I never had anything to do with this family or anybody associated with it. Giacalone was allegedly the boss in Detroit of organized crime. And I got a call from the FBI and Jim Campbell, who was the president of the ball club at the time, and said they wanted to see me down in Jim's office. So I went down and saw the FBI, the two agents, and they sat me down. And the first question out of their mouth was, tell us about Jack Aloney. And I said, I've never met Mr. Aloney. And, and they looked at me like, oh, you're BSing us, aren't you? I said, I don't know what you mean by that. BS and what? I said, I never met this guy. I said, I don't know his first name. I don't know his last name, but I understand it's Jack Aloney. He said, Jack Aloney, that's his whole last name. Don't you understand that?
Now, I understand, and we explain in the book, Denny was a kid, okay? He's 23, 24. He gets hooked up because he's playing the organ at a little bar called the Shorthorn in Flint. A bunch of just low-life, degenerate gamblers.
But they paid me a grand a week.
Okay. But no big-time guys at all. It was one of the most small-time, botched bookmaking things.
No, it wasn't.
You lost money.
The bookmaking thing.
As soon as they used your money, you never won another bet again.
But let me run one.
You were making more money at that little gig than you were in baseball. $1,000 a week.
My friend, who was a big executive at Pepsi-Cola, was an addictive gambler.
Yeah.
He got in a lot of trouble on some kind of a crazy horse race that never even ran.
Ed something.
And they stuck it. Yeah, I don't want to put his last name out. So Eddie called me and he says, I owe these guys 40 grand. I says, Ed, what did you do? I thought he killed somebody or something. He says, I bet on a horse. I lost the horse. It was supposed to be a lock. The race was supposed to be fixed. I says, fixed. You know that'll never happen. So he said, I got to get a hold of 40 grand. I've only got till Friday, and this was Tuesday. So I loaned him 40 grand. That was my total connection to the mobsters in Detroit. I gave Eddie the 40. Now, wait a minute, better than that. Later on, his son told me that Ed only gave him 20.
Speaking of his son, I grew up in Grosse Pointe Park, and also in Grosse Pointe Park, just about 7 or 8 blocks from me, just right almost on the city of Detroit border on the east side, that's where the Jackalones had their mafia compound.
Really?
So Anthony Jackalone Jr. went to high school with me. He was a year or two older.
Really?
And he showed up every day. He had a bodyguard usually with this amazingly hot. Remember the Oldsmobile Tornado? That beautiful luxury car.
Tornado.
I'm sorry, you're right. Thank you. So anyway, he shows up every day and he comes, man, this is the 60s. You know, we're wearing love beads and doing our thing. This guy comes in like with these unbelievably expensive clothes, but they were, you know, kind of tacky. You wouldn't be caught that. Not only did I never say a word to him, I never knew anybody who did, because he just, man, that's Jack Aloney. You don't go anywhere near this guy.
Mob guys are scary. I couldn't even eye contact with Tony Soprano during The Sopranos.
I was also a friend in high school. Great guy, Vince Quazzarano. So, you know, Vince and I had gym together. We hung out and everything like that. It wasn't until many years after I graduated from high school, I learned that his dad was Jimmy the Q Quazzarano. So I don't know, man. The sins of the father, as they say, should not be visited on the son.
But well, I'll give you one little tidbit. There was a real nice restaurant at Telegraph and 7 Mile, and I can't remember. It was a prime rib house, beautiful restaurant.
I remember that. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it, but Topinka's, I think it
was.
Yes,
of course.
And I was told by Ed Schober, if you take the $40,000 and go down to Topinka's in the parking lot, someone will step out in front of your car and will take the money from you. I said, you want me to go in the middle of winter at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night when it's pitch dark and hand somebody 40 grand in a parking lot? Is that what you want me to do?
By the way, you mentioned the name of the guy.
Eli, the great irony about Denny's situation right there is that nowadays, if you go the same place, 7 Mile and Telegraph, and you step out into the parking lot with any amount of money, they will take the money from you.
By the way, I looked up the Sports Illustrated cover. I sent it to Brandon from February 23rd, 1970. And there's only one left in stock, $27, including shipping. Light water damage in the right edge, crease in the bottom corner, not autographed for 27. Let's buy 100 of them and you autograph them. let's move on here.
Well, yes, baseball spring training is underway, right?
Yeah, but, you know, let me tell you something, which I think is the overall thing that just stuns me about all of this. There is still no schedule to Major League Baseball.
What do you mean this there's no? There is a schedule.
Yeah, they have. They've announced when the games are going to start.
They know when they're going to start. They haven't finalized the schedule yet. They're not sure how long they can play, if it's going to be. There is. You have not seen a schedule of who is going to play.
But hang on a minute. That's not true. What they have, they've got a schedule structured already. They just haven't announced it. You're going to play 40 games in your division, and you're going to play 20 games out of your division. You're going to play interleague the other 20 games. So they've got the schedule set. They just haven't published it yet. You know why? They're waiting to see what other players are going to bow out. They really are. There's four guys already that have bowed out. And some of them are stars, including Zimmerman.
Well, what's that got to do with it? My point about the schedule, they still haven't released it. They can still change it. They're still deciding. They could add a game, take away. But the schedule is what made baseball what it was. It was the first organized league. And before the schedule, it was all barnstorming. It's a schedule that gives spectator sports its official
nature. That's a good point. Yeah, because let's say the Tigers schedule comes out.
Exactly.
Oh, look, the Yankees are coming in for four games
the
in September.
The reason
you know?
The promoters of baseball created leagues and schedules was to create just this, a year-by-year compilation of regular organized baseball. That's why they call it organized, with records and uniformity, organized, sortable, record-producing. It's the standard, home and away, 154 games, 162 games. And so to me, it's the ultimate example, not that I'm getting too philosophical here, of this crazy situation where we guys are coming to training camp, but we still don't know who the Tigers will open with, where they'll open, and who's going to be on any roster. It's just whack.
And then, of course, we talk about the new rules. So, as you know, among the many new rules that baseball has instituted, no more chewing tobacco, boys. No
We're
peanut
spitting.
Shells, no sunflower seeds, and no spitting. But here's my question. What if somebody does? Do they have any penalties? Is it automatic immediate ejection? Do they get a warning if they spit? You know,
they will give you a fine for spitting.
Well, yeah.
With no warning.
No warning.
The only thing they've been able to do is to create 113-page protocol thing. The same length, by the way, the NBA. Ironic how they're both 113.
But don't you understand? They have to start with something. You got to put it down
exactly
first.
That's all they've been able to do. We can see the protocols before the damn schedule.
But Eli, there's only. But wait a minute. There's only the schedule is there. I just told you how it's going to work.
It could still change. It's fungible.
Well, no question. They can change it. Listen, I think they're going to do some things on the fly because I think there's going to be a number. Once they start testing everybody in a regular base, I mean, like starting today and tomorrow, you are going to see some players that have got the virus and things will change. Every day they're going to change. I'm beginning to change my mind that we'll never finish this season.
You could be.
Who knows what's going to happen? Now, you can chew gum. Do you guys remember what Joe Torre did in the Yankees dugout all the years he managed the club? I never asked Joe why. I don't know why I didn't. Joe was always sucking on a peach pit. Is that legal or could you pass COVID-19 that way? You know, the whole thing is just a kerfuffle. And Denny, I don't know if you guys saw this yet, but just this morning, as we were recording this show Thursday, a multi-year deal with sportsbook PointsBet was announced by the Tigers.
Oh, yeah.
This is the first such partnership between a Major League Baseball franchise and a bookmaker beginning this year. PointsBet signage is going to be up at Comerica. The sportsbook will be featured on the Tigers radio network and on the team's twice weekly live streaming. The word on Woodward.
Wait
a minute. Let me just one more sentence here. PointsBet also will be integrated into the District Detroit app. You know, the surrounding area around Comerica and of course, Little Caesars Arena, as well as MLB's ballpark app.
Well, let me say this to you, and I got suspended for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the worst part about that suspension was, and we just started looking into it a couple of weeks ago, I lost a year of pension. They took a year of pension away from me in 1970 for being innocent, totally innocent.
One of the few times you were innocent, but you were innocent
one of the few times. Absolutely. Yeah, starting with the Schwinn bicycle. So
Wait. Go back on that. What's the Schwinn bicycle?
I don't want to hear another story.
My neighbor stole my bike, and I went back and stole it back. That's all. And he never, ever tried to take another bike from anybody. By the way, a couple of other things with Eli's doubting Thomas attitude today. Each league is going to have a DH. if you are in extra innings, you're going to put a man on second base.
No, we've talked about it.
By the way, okay. We can say it again. Not everybody.
Well, Eli's got to go to a commercial.
And you know what else? Derek Jeter, Mr. Baseball of the New York Yankees for 100 years, and now not so much Mr. Baseball as a manager in the general manager's office, says
he's the owner
He hated extra inning games. I don't know where the hell that comes from. I've never heard anybody say they hated extra innings. You know what that gives you an opportunity to do when you do extra innings? Win a game.
And get more at-bats, more stats. Yeah. Hey, we'd like to welcome again a couple of new sponsors. Feldman Automotive, Michigan's number one Chevy dealer, number one 800 pre-owned Supercenter 2 located in Waterford. 7 additional locations where you can buy used cars, 1-800 pre-owned cars, as well as new ones. He's got 5 Chevy dealers. The Chevy dealers with the Feldman Group are Novi, New Hudson, Lansing, Livonia, and Highland, Feldman Hyundai in New Hudson, Feldman Kia, Novi. That means there's a Feldman dealership and a used or certified pre-owned vehicle near you. Almost any pre-owned comes with exclusive drive it for 3 days, love it, or bring it back. It's a can't-lose proposition. So let us know. Share the experience. We'll stand behind you. If you're looking for a new or pre-owned car, shop Feldman. Let us know. Give us feedback. We want you to show support to the show by supporting our sponsors. So 9 locations, guaranteed credit approval. You can also buy online at FeldmanAuto.com. Hassle-free at home or in the showroom. Support the Feldman Group. Also encourage you to look into Power Home Solar, based right here in Detroit, America's fastest growing solar energy company. All their state-of-the-art panels are made in America. Save money. Help save the environment. Help yourself avoid power outages because Power Home Solar is partnered with Generac, nation's largest provider of in-home backup battery and generator systems. Lower your energy bills and eliminate power outages forever. Owner Jason Waller and Power Home Solar have financing starting at $99 a month. Call them at 1-800-POWER-90 and save an additional $1,800. Support our guys so they'll continue to support us. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. One thing you guys didn't mention about baseball is that I brought up in the last show, I thought I knew the answer, but I wasn't sure. The minor leagues are done.
Yes,
minor leagues are out. And they're going to have 60 players on the major league team. That's why I agree with
you. Yes, they are.
That Torkelson, who they, by the way, signed to a record contract. Is it something like $8.4 million?
Yep.
Yeah, $8.4 million.
Every year it just keeps going up. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to see him play. That's exciting. And
that's right. You are going to see him play. Almost immediately, watch what happens. I agree with you. They're all going to play. Mize is going. They have to play these kids. They have to play them.
Well, and Brandon, that's a reason for me to watch because I do. I'm anxious to see these kids. Though I have seen already a bunch of the Tigers kid pitchers at the minor league level. You know, posted on Twitter Monday afternoon was a message from MLB's Zimmerman. He wrote, "I have 3 young children, a newborn, and a wife who is at high risk. Therefore, I will not be able to play in the 2020 season." Now, I was just at that point on the verge of leaping out of my chair, thrusting my right fist into the air and shouting, "Yes!" Then upon further review, it turned out to be Ryan Zimmerman, not Jordan Zimmerman. So unfortunately, Jordan's on that 60-man roster, right?
Well, you know, so generally, it's 25 major league players on the roster, and then they have a 40-man roster where the other 15 are generally down at Toledo and they bring them back and forth. So with a 60-man roster, there's really over 2 full teams there. So you've got your AAA team and your major league team all in town, even a little more than AAA team. The other guys are going to be in the other minors. They're all going to get restructured soon enough. They're going to eliminate 40 teams the year after, eliminate all the lower echelon like A and rookie ball and all that, which is sad in many, many ways, but you're kind of seeing the future of baseball in this ridiculous little season here.
Well,
there's going to be fewer minor leaguers and,
there's two things to this thing with the pitchers. One is that they're going to make a pitcher pitch to at least 3 hitters. That's a horrible, horrible idea. And secondly, you're going to have relievers go out there that aren't ready to pitch because you're going to have.
No, Todd, wait a minute. Todd Jones said he thought it was a good idea. Why do you think it's a horrible idea?
Please let me finish.
I will. I want to hear this, though.
One time, let me finish. Dear God, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. The idea of 60 men on a roster is a huge number. It's a football team, right? In all sense.
Right.
But what they're going to do, the teams are not limited to the number of pitchers that they can carry in the 60-man roster. That's a mistake. they should have a limit on the number of pitchers. You're going to have some teams carrying 20, 25 pitchers. Yeah. You watch. You watch what's going on. You're going to have a new kid in there about every other night. And Lord only knows what's going to happen. They want to talk about shortening up the game. By putting 20 pitchers out there, you're not going to shorten up anything. You may be playing in December.
Well, why do you hate the must face three hitters for relievers?
Because it's got a lot to do with managing a baseball team. You got a left-handed hitter up, you bring a left-handed pitcher in. You got a right-hander in, you bring a right-handed pitcher in. That's part of the strategy of managing a baseball team, of playing the game, hitting and running, running and hitting, bunting, sacrificing. All of those things become a part of the game. If you're going to do this with all of these pitchers and make them do this, this, and this, you're asking for a very long game. Just the first point is they're going to have longer games, and that's not going to help anybody.
We're not going to make as many pitching changes. What do you mean if you got to face
three guys?
Are
you kidding? Are you kidding? Some guy goes out there and gives up three singles in a row, three doubles or home runs in a row, walks three guys.
They do that anyway.
That happens a lot.
And if a guy comes in with two outs in an inning, he only has to pitch one to one batter if they want to take him out after that. By the way, Torkelson will be the first regular position player to go right from college to the majors. You ready for this? Since Joey Amalfitano in 1954. So Kalen never went to college.
Joey Amalfitano, oh, right off our childhood baseball card, San Francisco Giants infielder. Well, so anyway, as you regular listeners know, our COVID-19 discussions here have often been divisive enough, but we do not do politics or religion. We've said that from day one, and we don't. Why would we? You just tend to alienate half your audience. And yet here come the New York Yankees, who are now being encouraged to speak out on social issues. Aaron Judge, Giancarlo Stanton, and Aaron Hicks recently participated with former Yankee pitcher, retired now, CC Sabathia, in a Black Lives Matter video. They're active on social media. And Aaron Boone, the Yankees manager, said he is glad to see his players share their opinions. But they're going to piss a lot of people off. Is this right?
Bob, I don't think Eli and I are talking about the same thing. We want to keep it off our show. Listen, if the Yankees want to go out there along with the NBA and the CBA and everybody else, the Canadian Hockey League and everything else, that's fine. They are free to do that. We just don't want to do it on our show. That's all.
No, I'm not arguing. Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's right.
It's got nothing to do with stopping other people. Other people, listen, they're all entitled to their opinion. Let them have it. Let them have it.
I guess we're just used to Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan, to name two notables, saying, whoa, leave me out of this. Oh, I don't want to have a comment on that.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's fair to these are very different times. I mean, like we said the other day on Monday, I couldn't believe the headline that NBA players would be allowed to put social comments on their uniforms.
I can't either.
That is just, that's just knuckling under to a ridiculous degree.
The good news there, good news, bad news, in between news. It's all kind of crazy news from time to time, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to anybody, but they're one thing they're not going to do is put anybody's name on the back of the shirt. Nobody's going to have their name with a saying that is going to be applied to the shirt. Nobody. So
and Eli,
they can do the Black Lives line. They can do anything else that they
no
want
names.
As long as within,
I don't think you just mentioned this, did you, Eli? The NBA now says it is planning to paint Black Lives Matter on every court inside the sidelines in all three arenas.
This is a total capitulation to the players that I think is spineless and gutless. Aren't we supposed to try and pretend that sports is going to take our minds off the troubles in our lives? It's going to give people a place to go and forget about the trouble. I remember in 2009 when houses were getting foreclosed right and left. And I had this little conversation with Lindsey Hunter, who was giving me, he had come back to the Pistons. I love Lindsey. He was kind of in the end phase of his career. He'd been a few other teams. And he's talking about the typical, this will give fans something to cheer about, help them get through this. I go, cameras off. I go, Lindsey, really? They foreclose your house. Pretty soon your furniture is going to be in the front lawn and you're going to dribble a basketball and make their lives seem better. He goes, yeah, you're right. You're right.
Now let me give you the definition of.
And this is gonna make it worse if you're gonna try to escape the sports and ignore no fans on the field in the stands. You're gonna be so pissed off by a guy who's got a I can't breathe in the back of his thing or white power on the other one. It's so anti everything.
Yeah, we'll see if it's white. We'll see if anybody has white power. That would not be politically correct.
I'm gonna explain extortion to you.
Yeah, that's it. There it is.
The Washington Redskins have faced renewed pressure from people who are protesting against the Redskins' name. And 87 investment firms and shareholders worth a combined $620 billion of net worth asking the companies to sever ties with the Redskins until they change their controversial name. Now, isn't that extortion? If you don't change that name, I am going to boycott you. I'm going to make everybody not pay you. Didn't an attorney just go to jail in California?
I don't know, but none of us have an attorney.
That's right. But
Denny, wouldn't that also constitute, again, we're not attorneys, tortuous interference?
Yeah, I would think so.
With a business contract. This stuff's going on. So, now, I don't recall seeing anybody else but me saying this just a couple of weeks ago, that it won't be long until the PC idiots start tearing down statues of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. We're getting closer all the time now. So some University of Wisconsin students are pushing for a statue of Abraham bleeping Lincoln to be removed from the Madison campus over his treatment of indigenous groups and black people. The Black Student Union and the Student Inclusion Coalition has called for Lincoln's statue to be removed, despite him, of course, ending slavery in the United
States.
These are rogue
criminals who should be stopped. And I hate to see a movement that the majority of Americans support go to these extremes. Extremism is no place for it. That's ridiculous. Now, by the same token, in terms of the Redskins, now it's true, it's a brand. But what's wrong with renaming a base or a military base to another name from some guy who was a dead Civil War general who tried to destroy the Republic that we all love and believe in? What is wrong with changing the name? That's a little bit different. Now, the Redskins, a different story.
You start doing brand, it.
But then again, it's still a name. It's not going to let one less person come to the ballpark.
No.
Eli, you just
slammed these people as a group. I know you're not going to slam Michigan Governor Whitmer the same way. She announced Tuesday she's renaming a state office building in Lansing that was named after a slave owner, Lewis Cass, who was a Democrat who lived 1782 to 1866, great son of Michigan, U.S. Senator, U.S. Secretary of State, Secretary of War, but he was at one time a slave owner. This is in the 1830s. Again, Jefferson and Washington, it's all coming down, according to some of these people.
Well, I've got the answer. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do. I think eventually it's going to get to this. I think they should have a couple of museums throughout the South.
Absolutely.
Because this is where most of this generated.
Yeah.
And take these statues. Don't break them. Don't burn them. Don't throw them away. But put them in museums whereby the historical value can still be supported.
Now, are you going to go down there and clean the spray paint off the museum?
Give people the option. Just give people the option to keep them around. There's a history there, a tremendous amount of history. When we were growing up, the three of us, hey, listen, I'll bet our history books that we read every ding-dang day had an awful lot of this in it.
You can't replace history. You can only learn from it. So I agree with you. Fort Benning is the one I'm thinking of. So change the name. Yes. If it offends people and he was a pro-South, pro-slavery, pro-secession, all that, change the name. Who cares? It's just a damn name, and he's been dead for 100 years. There's no nobility in keeping it. But yes, so I agree with you.
Let me throw a name out at you, boys. Howard Zinn. Anybody with me?
Yes, love Howard Zinn.
Of course. So Howard Zinn is with late
history of the world. Yeah.
No. He wrote A People's History of the United States, in which he really told the truth about how this country was really built and shaped, the stories that none of us ever learned in public school. A lot of people know about that book. People read it. Folks, if you haven't read this, if you like history, pick up this book. It's important that we all understand this, but all, again, like as Eli's saying right now, all this constant renaming and so ostracizing, whatever.
Now, Howard Zinn, it was the people's history. What he did was he wrote it from the standpoint of the people who lost, not the people who won. So right. instead of Columbus coming and discovering America, you wrote it from the point of view of the people who were killed, disenfranchised, stolen from all the way through. So that's why it's an interesting perspective, because history is only valid from the last person who told you about it. A lot of it's interpretive anyway.
And guess who else just poked up the other day, just popped up online the other day? Russell Wilson and Antonio Brown are throwing passes to each other.
Great.
Get ready. And my buddy Kaepernick, he's on the road again. He's throwing passes to people. And here's the worst idea I've ever heard in the NFL. The NFL teams are going to fly into the city they're playing in on the same day of the game.
Ooh,
doesn't work.
That's a disadvantage. Work. Oh, you're kidding.
Man, is it ever?
Oh, man. Won't I work. Didn't hear that.
Yeah, won't work.
Well, sorry, the NFL has now canceled weeks 1 and 4 of the preseason schedule. Yeah. And that's disappointing, because that means the NFLs are not going to play the Patriots. I mean, I wanted to look at Cam Newton, as does everybody else.
Me too.
If the current trajectory of this COVID-19 thing doesn't change in the next 2 weeks, playing the college football season is in significant peril. USA Today has reported they had conversations with more than a dozen administrators and coaches, all off the record. They're saying there's just too much uncertainty and alarm. The Ivy League is already saying it's planning a 7-game spring football season in lieu of fall sports. And get this. Now, this is only one guy. This is only his opinion. He doesn't know. Nobody knows. But Dr. Sheldon Jacobson, a computer science professor at the University of Illinois, he's not a medical expert, told CBS Sports that if the roughly 13,000 players return for college football this year, that 30 to 50% of them will contract COVID-19. And he says 3 to 7 players will die. And this is a blazing headline in the New York Post today. One guy. Now, he might be right. He might be wrong. But, I mean, this is just crazy stuff.
Well, you know, I must say that 3 to 7 players die every year in football, whether it's high school.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So it's all the way you look at it. But and that woman, I forget her name, the doctor that Lynn Henning retweeted, said that every baseball player will get. I want to talk about the NBA and also some other facts about the
How
NBA.
About Amoni Bates, and how about the fact that Detroit, where you guys are, has its own PGA Tour stop. Beginning.
Let's get into that in a moment. First, I want
to in one moment, Hall. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Commissioner Landis. They want to kick him out now.
Who's Landis?
Judge Landis.
Judge Landis, a federal judge that cleaned up 1919 White Sox gambling.
All right, Black Sox.
Well, he was a racist, but anyway, go ahead.
All right, so David Hall and Hall Financial are out there helping people save some money. It was a great time to refinance, as you know, and if you haven't in the last year. Now's the time you can lower your monthly payments. I did it, lowered my monthly payment, saved a bunch of money, and got it done really, really fast through Hall Financial, less than 2 weeks. They don't promise less than 2 weeks, but it's about that time, and it's the fastest in the business. That's why they have 1,500 five-star reviews from Michigan homeowners. So go to hallfinancial.com or David Hall Financial and get started, or call them at 248-308-5000. You refinance, you can probably miss up to a couple of payments. That's even more money that you save. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, more personal attention. David Hall Financial, 248-308-5000. And you should also call Luke Nowacki of Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. His number, 248-663-4748. Luke has been doing this for over 2 decades. Individuals, families, businesses. He's got a view of the entire landscape and can tell you how you fit in when he gets your information, and it's all free to reach your financial goals. Free consultation, complimentary, and it's another no-lose proposition. Check out Luke. Talk to him, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. He supports us, and we support him too. And again, you go talk to Luke, give us some feedback, let us know how our sponsors are doing. Advisory service off the Royal Alliance Associates, Inc., other marketing names, product service, reference here, independent of Royal Alliance Associates. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. That NCAA thing is very interesting. The guy you quoted, Dr. Sheldon Jacobson. You know, two examples. Clemson, 37 players, a third of their roster have tested positive.
Yeah.
And at Arizona,
Eli, let me interrupt you for 1 second here. Did you hear about Boomer Esiason? So Boomer has a morning show on WFAN in New York City. He hosts it. And he, on the air the other day, alluded to the idea, ready, that Clemson and other college football teams down south, with all these players recently testing positive for COVID-19, did it on purpose. He said that he found it odd that so many players from Clemson, Alabama, LSU, et cetera, are testing positive suddenly. So he suggests that they're deliberately infecting these guys. So they're trying to get herd immunity for their teams. In other words, everybody else comes down with COVID, but hey, we've already been through that. We ain't going to get it. And of course, there's no scientific proof about whether you can get COVID again once you've already had it and recovered from it. This lunacy, Eli.
Well, there was a letter, I don't think you read it last week, where the guy said, don't put it past baseball that players will purposely infect the other team to get them to drop out.
I've got that ready to go in the mailbag today. Yep.
That's kind of an opposite COVID strategy.
I mean, that's silly. The Clemson thing, not the general, but one of the athletic directors over there positioned it very well when all of this started to hit the fan over there. They said, listen, they're all coming back to school. They all want to start working out again. And what they did for the first week until they started putting their uniform back on was go to the frat parties every night with the entire football team. So they're not doing anything on purpose. They're just being stupid.
Exactly. They're just being – so this, in Arizona, I'm not going to mention the player's name because they don't have it written down, and I figured I would spare him because after he heard that what's the point if there's no students allowed on campus, and at this point they aren't, the one player tweeted, quote, so why me and my team on campus then? In other words, why are we here working out when there may not be any football because – they're not going to have football if they don't invite the kids back to campus.
We have this big controversy. Wow, it's the second time I've mentioned one of my hometowns, the other being Livonia, on the show today, Grosse Pointe Park. So a bunch of kids from Grosse Pointe Park who go to Michigan State were up there. And, of course, they're hanging out in the bars. That's what kids do, okay? So a lot of them came down positive with COVID-19. Big deal. They're not going to get sick. They're not going to die. But they then went home not knowing that they were positive for COVID-19, right. And they saw mom and dad, and they saw, because they didn't know that they were potentially carriers. So this has been a huge deal. It's been a big story.
Well, there's a bar in Lansing that's got 130 people with the virus that all appear.
Maybe the same place.
Harper's. So by the way, I don't want to get into it here on a political basis, but here is a stat on Corona again that knocked me over when I saw it last night. I said this really can't be, but it is. The European Union, which is 27 countries in Europe.
This is a great stat.
The European Union has 446 million people. USA has 330 million, so they've got considerably more, about a third more. Well, on Tuesday, the European Union had 3,500 infections. On Tuesday, Arizona, with 7.3 million people, 1/60th, the number of the European Union, had 4,800 infections, 30% more.
Unbelievable.
I say, hello, don't take offense, Bob, hello to I won't wear a mask Neanderthals out there that even Donald Trump is just tired of he'll never admit he was wrong.
It's a good idea.
He'll never admit he was wrong. And he says, God, I'm so good looking in this mask. So he's trying to say, instead of saying, I led you astray, it is the number one way to help contain the virus. Right. It isn't unmanly. It isn't
Eli, you're going to be so proud of me. We have just passed the Palm Beach County Council has just passed a must wear mask law here in Palm Beach County.
Which you laughed at last time.
I did not. For all indoor places, outdoors, you do whatever you want. You don't have to wear a mask. You're
outdoors,
just fine.
Cool.
So now I was curious as to whether and how they would enforce this. So the other day I had to stop by. Yes, fans, I do enjoy a drink or three every now and then. I had to stop by a liquor store. They have a sign up on the front. Come in, you got to wear a mask. I got a mask in my car for emergencies. I put it on. I went in there, but then I had some questions. I wound up spending more time inside than I thought I would. I've been there 10 or 15 minutes. I finally asked one of the young women who worked there. I said, you wear a mask inside here 8 hours every day? I couldn't take it. It was hot. I felt like I'm suffocating. I finished. I went out, took my mask off, and went on my way. Some stores are requiring masks here. Others don't care. So that's what's going on.
Well, there's a reason why we're a joke throughout the world and why now, us banning people from other countries to fly here, now we're being banned from flying to Europe. Why? Because we didn't do the right thing. We let it grow. It's getting worse. And that's why Adam Silver and Rob Manfred and everybody else is saying, geez, I don't know. Did you see what, what's his name? The player for Toronto, Fred VanVleet, basically goes, boy, it sure seemed like a good idea about a month ago. I'm not so sure right now as they all go inside.
And then the other problem with us, we've been talking about all these people who tested positive, and people say, well, there are many more. The tests are unreliable. Yeah, they're unreliable both ways. So here's Cameron Champ. You guys probably don't know his name. He's a big, long driver on the PGA Tour. So he's one of the first of a handful of PGA players to withdraw from the Travelers Championship in Hartford last week when he tested positive for COVID-19. Then he took three tests in a 72-hour span. They all came back negative. So he's playing in Detroit this week at the Rocket Mortgage Classic. Novak Djokovic of tennis fame. You know, oh, he's not only positive, other people infected him. No, he's taken other tests. He and his wife are not positive for COVID-19. False testing added to this panic going on.
Bob, you know the problem with that? You got one test that says one thing, one test to say the other. What do you do? I mean, I'm not going into a crowd. And by the way, I got about 20 calls and a bunch of text messages this week. I mentioned something about not feeling well last week on the show. Let me clear it up quick. I just found out Monday, I've got a lot of fluid on my lungs and my heart. And lo and behold, they're treating it with medication. And today I can breathe again.
All right.
So, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. I cannot leave Eli and Bob alone. So here I am.
Are you taking a swipe at the I Can't Breathe Black Movement?
No.
Was that a cheap shot at them?
No. God, no.
But we're glad. Danny, you take care of yourself because you know we love you. And we don't want anything to happen to you. And yes, you're at risk. And there's no question about that.
So Stephen A. Smith, who we don't quote often, but he was pretty good the other day. I read this. I did not see it on First Take on Tuesday. He said, these NBA players going to the bubble, forget 3 months. It's not going to last 3 weeks that they're going to be able to go without sex. He goes, do we really?
I already mentioned that. I brought that up.
The other day?
On a recent show, I brought that up.
Well, he said it Tuesday. Yeah, but that's okay. I don't know how you would have brought it up Monday.
But we can bring it up more than once.
He said it on Tuesday. He said, do we really think the recreational activities these guys are accustomed to are going to be compromised for 3 months? I mean, somebody's got to say it. You really, really think they're going to honor a bubble for 3 months? And as it is, not to make fun at all, but Adam Silver remains pretty confident about the league's plan to safely resume, but he said a spread in the NBA could bring the league to a halt again.
Yeah, and Eli, I'm in a 16-year relationship. You and Patty have been married for 100 years. You can't go without sex for 3 months unless you're in our situation when it's just de rigueur and usual. Business as usual.
You know, Bob, you can talk about a lot of things, but kind of leave my sex life out of it.
Well, yeah. What Jesus. Sex life is that?
Mark Cuban says there's risk. But, you know, the other thing that Cuban and Silver say, which may be true, is that their players and knowing their lifestyle and the way they congregate or go out, they may be safer in the bubble. Well, that makes sense. They will be safer in the bubble. Are they going to really maintain the rules of the bubble? And as somebody alluded to earlier on the show, what are the penalties? Who are the watchdogs? You know what? We'll sit back and we'll watch.
I mentioned this thing as regards Cameron Champ, the golfer, I want to know, you two golf experts, I want to know your opinion about this tournament. What do you think about the Detroit Golf Club course where they play it? Do you think this tournament is going to last?
It's not a great course.
We'll talk about it.
It's a very easy golf course. Very easy golf. All you got to do is hit the ball and play because they keep the greens in such great shape this time of year. The winner will be somewhere between 16 and 20 under par
or more. I mean,
other than what Ricky Fowler and a couple other top name guys, I mean, nobody's really playing that the average golf fan like me people would recognize, right?
No, there's some pretty good players here this week.
Yeah, there are
a lot of really good players here this week.
And one other thing, while we've got a little pause in the action here.
The problem is, Bob, you've only heard of 20 guys on the tour, so you don't really.
That's BS, and you know it's BS. And if you want to go down a list, and we'll pick out
Gary
some names.
Stop that silliness.
I'll send you a list.
That's an inside joke, fans, because Eli accused me of never having heard of him before he won the United States.
No.
You heard him.
That was a fluke, and he was never going to win a major again,
Denny,
and I'm right.
Denny has the floor. Go ahead, Denny.
I will send you a list of the other 500 golfers, Bob.
I see the list.
Bob, you implied that Judge Landis was not a racist.
He was a racist, one of the worst ever.
Well, now you didn't say that a few minutes ago. Mike Schmidt and Terry Pendleton have filed some documents and some other things that support the fact that Landis's name on the MVP trophy should be taken off immediately because of the nature of his dissertations and conclusions to a lot of cases. But at the end of his career, Landis actually pitched hiring and bringing black ball players into Major League Baseball. It never went anywhere.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It never went anywhere. But, I bet there's something laying around someplace that would indicate that.
I got to say goodbye to our.
No, fellas.
I have to say goodbye. Excuse me. I have to say goodbye to our
one remaining. I got a big story here. Okay.
To our one remaining radio station. Now that DFM has gone down the crapper for sports. No surprise there. AM radio is as dead as a doornail anywhere. But anyway, so WDFN has switched formats from sports. So we're not on there anymore. We're still hanging on in WCWA in Toledo, at least for this show. And we got to say goodbye to that radio audience. Feel free to join us. And occasionally they actually play the right show. I understood that they played the wrong show this week, which doesn't surprise me for radio stations that have nobody working there anymore. So it's kind of, you can hear the crickets during the day, even there at WCWA. In any case, if you want to hear the rest of the podcast, you can download it at the NoFilterSportsPodcast.com. You've been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
Okay, so a bunch of guys on Twitter asked me this week if we were going to address losing WDFN through its format change. And that was a pretty good address you just made, Eli. Denny, you got any comments about that?
No, I'm a little disappointed, but it is what it is. And, we work very hard on this show. We try to bring the best possible. And, we're looking at adding some stations.
I want to go further than that. I mean, I've been in New York City 32 years, so I only kind of know what WDFN is. But you guys were both on that station. And we have a lot of people like Brandon's buddy, Sean Belizean, this week tweeting. And a lot of guys are saying who were on the air there in the Halcyon days, how great it was and how important it was to Detroit audiences and how they're going to miss it.
Well, I think it's bottom line, and I think Eli will agree, the nature of radio and television has changed forevermore, and it's going to change more and more every day, every week, every month. Every time you turn the TV station on now at night, there's two or three new kids on the air with a microphone in their hand. I don't know where the hell they're all coming from.
In fact, we even had a letter this week that maybe you'll read, so I won't steal it, where somebody wanted us to tell stories about
That's all in the mailbag today.
Well, let me just say this about that, okay? I've told the story where I was on FM radio and it was underground in 1974, 5, and 6. And then in 1977, the big three made it standard equipment and cars. And overnight, only two AM stations of any value survived in this market, WJR and WWJ. And as it is, they are the last holdouts. And FM now, and I describe radio as this. It's the Titanic heading towards the iceberg, and it gets closer all the time. There was a thing from the Entercom is going to fire all on-air talent except for maybe one person at their music stations. So, technology changes. There was a time where there was a thing called the telex machine that changed the world. Well, you know what happened, though? They created the fax machine. So every telex machine now was thrown out. And then they created scanning. So every fax machine was thrown out. Unfortunately, radio is a dead technology, close to dead. And you can get Sirius satellite radio, listen to anything you want.
So music on
radio is hanging on for dear life.
Excellent. Eli, do you remember when you were coming up in New York? Do you remember listening to WRVR? One of the great jazz stations in America. So this is 40 years ago, and it was a terrific station, as I said. And one day, at the precise stroke of noon, you get the jazz audiences listening, and the next record is Conway Twitty or George Jones. They changed their format to country and western without any announcement. They just went from Miles Davis or whatever to Conway bleeping Twitty. This stuff has been going on for a long time in broadcasting.
Yes, radio's holding on for dear life. A lot of fine people. I have some great friends that work in radio, and they've seen it coming. And it's just technology. You got Spotify, Pandora. You can listen to anything you want, anytime you want, iTunes, whatever. You just don't need this little jukebox called radio that's got too many commercials and not enough variety. And it's sad, but that's just technology. So be it.
It is the way it is. Yeah, our buddy Ken Calvert, even the great Detroit disc jockey, is still doing his rock and roll show, but he does it on a podcast or whatever KC does right now. You know what I'm saying? So it's all changed. So we got Hilmer Kenty. When do you want to do the mailbag?
I still got this day in sports. There's some amazing.
We got to do that. And I got
before you do this day in sports, you were talking about the Titanic and ice. You know what? The better portrayal of that, a better imitation of that is?
What?
The NHL players are not going to be quarantined. Now, is that the Titanic heading to the ice?
Jeez.
These guys are weaned on Pabst Blue Ribbon. And lo and behold, here we go, folks. You'd want to talk about not seeing hockey this year. I believe we're going to have that situation.
Brandon has a puzzled look on his face now.
Did he say something
fallacious?
No, I just hadn't heard of that, so I was just looking it up. I do know that a whole bunch of their players have already tested positive for coronavirus. Bunch.
Yeah. Well, if you look at other pandemics, which are very common throughout human history, how about the AIDS thing a number of years ago, where if you had sex with a person, you were going to die. You were going to get AIDS. So the NHL, the fighting didn't stop. The guys are out there, they're blooding each other and blood's flying everywhere. And they kept on keeping on and nobody died of AIDS in the NHL. I don't think they will of COVID-19 either. So, I mean, and by the way, that story I was trying to get at, this would have been a lead story for us on any other day. Imoni Bates signs with Michigan State, the greatest high school basketball player in America, out of Ypsilanti, Michigan. You can say that he's never going to play for Michigan State. He'll be in the NBA or whatever. But think about this. That was a headline story for 2 days on ESPN. Yeah. How many kids are seeing this? Wow, he's going to go to Michigan State? I want to go to Michigan State, too. That is a great coup. For Mike Garland, Tom Izzo's assistant, who I think was in charge of the recruiting, and Izzo himself and the Michigan State basketball program, even if Bates never does play for the Spartans.
I think, isn't it the first time? I mean, here you have the player of the year as a sophomore, and he's the only sophomore to ever win that player of the year award. Not even LeBron did it. And for some reason, he goes before their junior. Almost nobody commits before their junior year, but apparently he wasn't being recruited by the big schools for whatever reason. Maybe they thought he would turn pro by then. I don't know, but he says he's not going to play in the G League, which I think is going to become a more and more popular option. And so we'll see. But yes, it's a very big coup. And for Michigan people, it's please say it ain't so. But apparently it is.
I think the issue there is simply this, that Tom and Mike Garland were smart enough to be in from the time the kid was seventh grade. And Juwan Howard is a Johnny come lately. And I think Juwan would have been a big player for Imoni Bates had he been at Michigan this entire time.
Yeah. Here's real quick. We already said what happened when Denny returned in 1970 on this date 50 years ago, actually yesterday. Here's one. A lot of pitching ones. Washington Senators pitching legend Walter Johnson, only no-hitter of his career, no-hit Boston, 1-0. By the way, he won 414 games, only one no-hitter. I guess
that's an amazing stat in and of itself. Wow, I didn't know that.
Different game back then.
And by the way, I wouldn't mention this otherwise, that Joe DiMaggio tied Willie Keeler on this day, his 44-game streak, except that when I was growing up and reading about baseball and just feeling the grandeur and magnitude of the sport, that was the record that they said would never be broken. Yeah. Joe DiMaggio's, growing up in New York, the 56-game hitting streak.
Hey, Eli, one other thing about Walter Johnson. Well, two other things, actually. First of all, they had those tiny, tiny little gloves. They weren't very good for catching baseballs, and there were no black or Latino players. There were no Latino players to make amazing stops at shortstop. No black road runners in the outfield to leap over fences and pull home runs back. So I think that was probably the big reason why Walter Johnson never did pitch more than one no-hitter.
Baseball's great shame. They could have the black baseball was incredibly popular in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
They got very big crowds, and yet baseball, if they could look back and see how stupid they were, and they probably do, they could have done it easily 20 years later and made the game greater.
I interviewed Bob Feller so many times, and I asked him about that a couple times. You know what Bob told me? And I quote you, I was a great friend to the colored ball player.
Okay.
I took Satchel Paige on barnstorming tours around the world, and I made Satchel Paige a lot of money. This was the thinking with a lot of these guys back then.
Bob was a real throwback to the old days.
Oh, yeah.
So 1945, Hank Greenberg returned from the war. The first superstar to come back at a home run his first game as the Tigers beat the Philadelphia A's 9-5. And, you know, 68 was an amazing year. Obviously, Denny won 31 games, all his other achievements that game that year. Bob Gibson's streak of 47 2/3 scoreless innings and then on a wild pitch. Can you imagine 47 2/3 scoreless innings? And by the way,
Gibby is probably still steaming that the ball should have been caught by McCarver.
By the way, they did lose the World Series that year.
Yes, they did.
Yes, they did, Danny.
By the way, remind you.
In 1987, WFAN in Detroit, and I'm sorry, WFAN in New York began the first 24-hour all-sports radio format. That was in 87. Pitching. This is amazing stuff. 1963, Willie Mays breaks up a Juan Marichal-Warren Spahn pitching duel in the 16th inning to win 1-0 for the Jets. Can you imagine two starting pitchers going 16 innings? And in 68, Louis Tiant struck out a major league record 19 twins. What was his ERA in 1968? He was 21-9 with a 1.60 ERA and 9 shutouts. So you were a great pitcher in 68. There were a couple other guys, man, like Bob Gibson. A
lot of good pitching.
That were right up there with you.
Bob Feller was a true American hero. Warren Spahn was not known at all in the 1940s during the war. He achieved his great fame, obviously, after the war. They sent him to the European Theater of Operations as a 21-year-old lieutenant. He said he was utterly shocked when he got there by the stacks of dead American Marines and soldiers. They were piled up. Spahn said after he was in combat for a month, you'd sit down and just eat your mess next to stacks of our dead American boys. God. These guys are American heroes. They were American heroes. Greenberg went in.
1933, Carl Hubbell of the Giants works 18 innings of shutout ball without a walk to beat the Cardinals 1-0. You know, these pitching feats are just
people don't realize how many times starting pitcher, even through the 60s until those changes started, we all pitched 3-4 times a year into the 10th, 11th, 12th inning. Because nobody ever wanted to give up the ball to the bullpen because that's where all the bushers were.
All right, let's break out the best part of the show, the mailbag. Here we go.
Did you just call this the best part of the show?
I did it somewhat.
For you, that's an apostasy. Yeah, okay, I'm so impressed that you finally came to your senses.
I'm a born-again mailbag lover.
If you ever say that again, I'll crack you in the back of your head.
Let's go.
Tom Henderson writes us from Windsor, and I presume this is not, by the way, that Tom Henderson was such a terrific writer for the Free Press all those years. Anyway, he says, your podcast is a delight. Denny is the baseball master with a common sense approach to social issues. Bob, infuriating at times, but he does his homework. He's a good reporter. Eli's background and experience keeps the show humming along at a lively place. You guys are phenomenal. Well, this is really nice. I mean, to hear this stuff from people. And he goes on and he says all the guests are terrific. He wants us to get, fellas, you ready for this? Nancy Kerrigan on the show. We haven't had a figure skater either.
That's a joke. That's got to be a joke.
That's not a bad idea. Why? Why would it be a joke?
That might be interesting.
That would be interesting.
Hey, listen, she's almost at every card show I do up in Massachusetts.
Really?
Almost
every
show.
Why don't you call her and get her on?
I will.
Yeah,
I will.
That's pretty interesting.
Good idea. Thanks, Tom.
That's if we ever do another card show.
And then you know what we'll do? Then midway through, we'll bring Tanya Harding in.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. Next one.
I think this is a friend of yours, Josh Tabo. I presume that's how he pronounces it.
He says,
what's popping, everybody? Love the show. Day one listener. First, if you will, Bob keeps saying, hold off till 2021 for sports. Bob, who's to say things are going to be better by 2021? I wouldn't be surprised if we're still 12 months more away from things truly being normal-ish again. Not saying anything sports-wise will work out this year. I doubt it. But the powers that be need to keep trying to figure something out. Shout out to Brandon, the glue of the show. Love you guys. Signed, Teebs. Teebs, I'm with you, buddy. I just throw out 2021. I don't know when things are going to be better. 2022, 2023, who knows? Edward Zabick writes, hey, Bob, I know Eli hates the mailbag. Edward, you just heard it here first, buddy. He doesn't anymore. Eli now loves the mailbag. So he says, I'm going to keep this short, LOL. I was thinking about all these sports trying to start their seasons, and there's something I haven't heard anyone mention. How long will it take, listen to this, folks, for a team coach to sabotage an opposing team's players and try to give them COVID? Think about it. They already steal signs in the World Series. Why wouldn't they hire a COVID positive guy to somehow try to infect the other team's best players? He says he loves us. He loves the show. And Ed, buddy, we love you too. Now we'll, have another bourbon, okay?
By the way, I think it's the pitching coach with the White Sox that just got over the virus. He'd been hospitalized and everything for a couple of weeks, but I think he's back with the Sox now.
Here's one that I think is pretty interesting. Don writes, guys, I wonder if you would talk about some of your radio and TV days. Eli, I recall waking up early and fine-tuning WRIF all the way up in Flushing, Michigan, so I could hear you tell me of the outcome of Tommy Hearns versus Sugar Ray in 1981. Danny, I finally remember listening to you and that whole group on WXYT when I was driving every day from Ann Arbor to Detroit while attending law school. I remember well the day you told the whole story of the troubles you had had. We did it again on this show too, by the way, Don, and it was fascinating, so on and so forth. And I get this, we've gotten this a lot. I don't mind at all. Bob, I didn't know anything about you except what I read on the No Filter page. I'd like to hear more about your career with some great stories or highlights. So I think you guys know each other so well that you forget that a lot of listeners don't know you as well. Well, first of all, Don, thanks for
You're not going to give your whole history, are you? You're not going to give the whole history.
Not at all. I'm just going to say, first of all,
30 seconds.
All I'm going to say is this. First of all, Don, buddy, you really messed up back then. I was ringside in Vegas covering the Hearns-Leonard fight. And if you'd listened to my shows on WJZZ, you'd have much better reports than Eli's shows.
Bob, if you ever took the word I out of your vocabulary, you'd be totally speechless.
By the way, tell Don TKO 14 for Leonard. Okay.
So, Don, you blew it listening to Eli instead of me, pal. Call us or text us on our hotline, 760-89-BALLS. You can also tweet us, of course, at Eli Zara, at MU2Denny, or at Bob Page Sports. We have a question here from Randall in New Baltimore. He wants to ask me, Bob, you follow hockey more than most people. Who gets the number one overall NHL pick if they end up canceling the remainder of the season and can't play for a while? Does this ensure that they have to finish the 2019-2020 season? What if they can't play until spring of 21? I'm confused, Randall. That's our letter of the week. I'm confused too, buddy, and I got no idea how to answer your questions.
They'll rewrite all the rules again.
Yeah, really something
That's actually
else.
Really then, interesting. Do you redo the lottery? What do you do?
I don't know.
Everybody's asking
questions like this.
It'd be a big rewrite.
Are
you going to read the one? Go ahead.
I got one more here that I really wanted to read because it's complimentary to you, Eli.
How about this one? Scott Harvey wants to know.
Yeah, that's the one I wanted to read. Why don't you read it then?
The only part I'm looking at is it's going to be hard to squeeze in my buddy Fred Heumann if you keep getting such A-ticket guests. We had Fred scheduled twice, and Fred forgot two times. Yeah. So Fred's on my list right now.
Now you just made some more work for Brandon. Thanks a lot, Brandon. The kid doesn't need any more work, damn it. He's got to edit that. You know what, Eli? I threw that out. I wasn't even going to read that part of Scott's letter because, as you just said, that's the truth. We're not going to do it. Anyway, he says he's enjoyed the show since day one. He just particularly loved the Rupert Jones interview. Denny, I was 10 years old when you won 31 games and the Tigers won the series. That was the age, and really because of you, when I really fell in love with the game of baseball. I owe it to all you guys, you and the golden voice of Ernie Harwell. I'd sometimes listen to your West Coast games on my little transistor radio under my pillow when I was supposed to be sleeping. It's great to hear you on these podcasts, Denny, and I must say you are all class. Scott writes to me is, Bob, would you let me finish? Eli. Thanks for putting this little thing together. Well, actually, Scott, the show's kind of becoming a big thing. But yes, Eli, thanks for putting this little thing together. I've drifted away from sports a bit over the past few years. The teams we have to root for in the Detroit area have left us with little optimism whenever we do return to playing sports. I doubt I'm going to be paying much attention to it, but it's great to hear from the guests you guys have lined up. They've all been excellent. Keeps a little bit of that spark for sports alive in my life. Keep up the good work. I like that. And Eli, thank you. Really, Eli. There's no show without Eli Zara. And every time I say that, every time he says, oh, no, it's going to, but that's just the truth. There's no show without Eli Zara. So,
and I allow a lot to happen, like the mailbag that goes.
Yeah, now you're going to introduce Hilmer Kinty, aren't you?
Yeah, let's talk to Hilmer Kinty, the former lightweight champion of the world. Well, the Kronk Gym's Emmanuel Stewart trained 41 world champions. Tommy Hearns' emergence in the late 70s led Stewart and the Kronk to international fame. But what many forget is that Hearns wasn't Kronk's first champion. recall in March 1980, Joe Louis Arena opened for the first event. Yes, not hockey. It was boxing. Louis, who would die the next year in 81, was at ringside with Coleman Young. Now, Hearns fought a non-title bout that afternoon against a former welter champ named Angel Espada. The co-feature was 24-year-old Hilmer Kenty, just 16 pro fights, challenging the reigning lightweight champion Ernesto Espana, 26-0, and a fearsome puncher. Listen to a few snippets of how Kenty made Howard Cosell gradually change his tune that afternoon on national television.
Hello again, everyone. It's good to have you with us. We hope for a representative bout today. Espana, the defending champion, an overwhelming favorite. He should be. Kenty tries to slug with Espana. He will not be long for this contest. Frankly amazed at Kenty's confidence and his willingness to mix it up. Amazing thing to see Kenny carrying this fight with such confidence. Between rounds, he looked down at me, winked, gave me the sign. I know what I'm doing and I've got it. This kid is putting on some show. Hilmer Kenty.
Oh, you couldn't hear it at the time, but Hilmer joins us. And tell us about that day, Hilmer. You win in front of the legendary Joe Louis in the arena named after him, become the city's first champion since Louis over four decades. Joe, I know you're in the middle of the fight, but when you look back on it, what was that day like for you?
That was truly tremendous. I can tell you, though, Eli, I really felt confident going into that fight. I can't think of any fight that I felt more confident going into than that particular fight. I knew I was a huge underdog, but I thought we had put together a very good plan against Ernesto Espana, and a plan that would beat him. I knew I had a lot more speed than he had. I knew he was a much better puncher than I was, but I had the speed, and I was going to use that speed in terms of being very, very, very aggressive.
And lastly, before I let the other guys jump in with a question, you told me way back then that Hearns, and you guys were so close back then, you were a great team. Hearns said he saw Espana working out and said, you're going to beat him. You're a lot faster than he is. And you said that gave you confidence too.
Yeah, you know, I'd heard a lot of people saying, you know, we think you're going to win. We think you're going to do well. You know, of course, my coaches were saying that. Even Emmanuel said that. But I think the thing that gave me the most confidence is when Tommy Hearns said it. Because when Tommy Hearns says something like that, I mean, he really means it. He doesn't hold any punches. He doesn't pull any punches. If he thought I was going to be in a little trouble in that particular fight, he would have said something about it. Well, but when he said that, I really did. That gave me the confidence. That gave me even more confidence, I guess I should say, an assured confidence going into that fight.
Let's start at the beginning then. You were born in Texas. You moved to Columbus, Ohio, and got to Michigan. Tell us how you went from Texas to Columbus, Ohio, up to Detroit.
Yeah, every time I say when I first started boxing, I started in Columbus, Ohio. Boy, I don't get a whole bunch of cheers. Right there at Ohio State. But I did. I started boxing in Columbus, Ohio. And my coach, my amateur boxing coach, he knew Emmanuel Stewart extremely well. In fact, I knew Emmanuel extremely well.
Why? My only question is, why did you start boxing at Ohio State?
Well, it wasn't at Ohio State. I actually started boxing in Columbus, Ohio. We were living in Columbus, Ohio. And I really did. I had tried all the sports. You know, my brothers were very well at football, basketball, and baseball. They excelled in those sports. I tried those sports, just didn't do too well in them. And a couple of my friends, I noticed a couple of my friends were boxing at the recreation center, which I attended. And so I said, I'll try it out. And I started beating up my friends pretty badly, actually. And my coach told me, you know, my coach at that time, he told me, you know, I think you got a future in this. And so I continued to do it. And, of course, I won the Golden Gloves. This is way back in 1969. I won the first Golden Gloves in which I fought in. And then continued to win several tournaments after that.
We both had a good year in 69.
Yeah. I was thinking about that. And one thing I always think about you, Denny, is boy, it had to be really tough for you coming into the majors at such a young age. I mean, it was tough for me at 24 to grasp being a world champion. But for you to go into the majors that at such a young age, that had to be tough for you to deal with.
Yeah, the most shocking thing that ever happened to me, the first night I was in the big leagues, I met K-Line and Rocky Colavito on the same bench. And it just, I almost peed down my leg. That's how excited I was.
Danny was asking you about your background. Your name is James Kenty. Is Hilmer your middle name? Where did that come from?
No, actually, my first name is Hilmer. So it's Hilmer James Kenty. My amateur coach, he just did not like the name Hilmer, you know, and every time when we would apply for national tournaments or apply for tournaments, he would always put my name in as James, you know, and, you know, he would fill all of the application out. And of course, I would sign the application, but he would always put down James Kenty. And so for all of my amateur career, basically, I went by James Kenty. It did not become Hilmer Kenty until I turned professional. And, of course, I was a lot older at that time, so I could pretty much call at least some of the shots.
You know, and then you were offered – didn't Bob Arum offer you, or somebody offered you like a gazillion dollars if you changed your name, capitalizing on roots, to Kunta?
I wish that had happened, because if that would have happened, I would have taken $1 million. My name is Gunter right now.
I heard
now,
that.
Now, I want to get back to the fact. So you're in Columbus and you're a kid and you're boxing. This is a day in the early 70s. You fought Sugar Ray Leonard in the Golden Gloves in 73. You beat Aaron Pryor for the National AU Lightweight title. You had 136 amateur fights. Stunning. Yeah. And you should have been, I thought, or certainly good enough to be on that 76 Olympic team. Back then, boxing became very, very big. You had Leonard, you had the Spinks, and Howard Davis Jr., you lost to him in 76 on points. Had you beaten him, you should have been or could have been on that Olympic team too. What are your thoughts, and what was it like back then to be an amazing amateur boxer but not get to the exposure that those guys got?
Yeah, first of all, Ray Leonard, I remember when I fought Ray Leonard, I just thought to myself, going through that tournament, of course, he's on one side of the bracket, I'm on the other side of the bracket, and we're both moving towards that championship fight. He really was. He was just amazing in that tournament. I guess the only problem that I noticed that he was having is he was having problems with his weight. He just had a real problem trying to make that weight. And getting into that championship fight, I did everything I possibly could to just simply outbox him. And I was able to do that, I thought. It was a very close decision. One judge gave it to me. Two of the judges gave it to him. And thankfully, he moved up the very next tournament. He moved well, up in weight the very next tournament.
You know, Hilmer, we hear so many things about so many bad promoters, the reputations of the promoters throughout boxing for years, decades. How were you treated by the promoters? Are you satisfied the way you were? Did you make enough money? That type of thing?
Well, I guess you never really make enough money. And you never I mean, especially back in those days, we just didn't make the type of money they're making nowadays. I mean, most of the fights that I had in today's market would be million-dollar fights. Yeah. Of course, they weren't million-dollar fights at that particular time. But I really did. I thought I was treated fairly by promoters and by boxing in general. You know, the fact that I got that championship fight so fast, I just thought was amazing. The one thing I really do, I have just to take my hat off to Emmanuel Stewart. I mean, everybody knows he's a great trainer because, like Eli said, he's trained 41 champions. But it's not just the fact that he trains fighters very well. He understands the mental part of boxing. He understands how to get in your mind, how to get you prepared, how to get you confident, you know, and of course, he knows all of the boxing techniques that you need to go through. I just thought he was just amazing in everything he did. I can't think of anything that he did that he did not do extremely well. Even when he went into commentating, you know, he did an excellent job there too.
Yes, he did.
He just really did. I just thought he worked so hard at his craft, and I just thought he just had a lot of natural talent in just about everything that he did.
And a nice guy. Super.
He was a hell of an electrician, too, for the city of Detroit. I mean, he could do a lot of things, actually.
Yeah, I remember when I first met him, I think when I first met Emmanuel, he had come to Columbus, Ohio, because he was actually selling insurance. So I think he sold some insurance, too, at some point in time in his life. So he did a little bit of everything, but he finally found his niche when he let go of everyone, everything else, and started boxing.
Yeah, Homer, that was such a I'm sorry. I was going to say that was such a great stable. You've been talking about this. I covered Olympic boxing in Los Angeles in 1984, and we had Stevie McCrory from the Crocs stable on that unfortunately dead. I'd like you to talk about his big brother, Milton McCrory, Stevie, Mickey Goodwin, and some of the other great fighters who came out of Croc.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I can tell you right now, you know, Stevie McCrory, you know, he's only 112 pounds.
Yeah, right.
But I can remember me and Tommy both being in the gym. You know, we trained right after the amateurs came in. We would come in right after the amateurs came in and train, and we would watch him sprawl. We'd get there a little early sometimes, and we'd watch him sprawl. And I can tell you right now, I was shaking my head because it was unbelievable some of the things that I saw him do. It was just absolutely unbelievable. He made things look so easy, you know. His offense, his defense, it just looked like everything was just so natural for him. And like I said, he just made it look extremely easy. He made it look like anybody could do it.
You know, when we talk about Emmanuel, now I remember his Milton McCrory, he was Stevie's older brother, I think, right? Milton was.
I said that.
Mm-hmm. And Milton always would say to me, you know, you can talk about Tommy Hearns, you can talk about Hilmer Kenty, but I'm the first guy born in Detroit that actually won a title on the Crunk team. So that was, but here's the thing. All these kids in Detroit, I used to think, if you scouted them for Major League Baseball players, would you find 10 in the town? No, you wouldn't. But look at the world champions, from McCrory to Tommy to Frank Tate, all these guys from Detroit. It had to be Emmanuel, right? Because you don't have 10 champions just rise up in one particular town. So it wasn't just the talent, but he was able to find it and nurture it. And, man, there was no boxing in Detroit. And to think to go from zero to what he produced in that short period of time and made it such a part of the sports scene, I know we're all agreeing with this, was really remarkable when you look
back. Yeah.
And the other thing you have to take into consideration, and Emmanuel, he wasn't just our trainer. He was also our manager too.
Yeah.
So he was doing double duty there. And he worked very closely with a lot of the promoters, you know? So I really did. His day had to be unbelievably tiring. I mean, he had to work 12-hour days just about every day. But I think he really enjoyed it.
And you know what made it so tough? I would come down to the Kronk to interview you and Tommy and the guys, and Eli would too. A lot of people don't know this. You'd walk into the Kronk, and he had the temperature inside there at about 110 bleeping degrees. You could hardly stand it. But you guys excelled despite that heat.
Yeah, I think that was – I think that was
– did it on purpose.
Yeah, and I really do.
Sure.
I think that was very good for us because I remember when I fought Espana for that championship fight, and I'm just being honest, the most rounds I went in the gym was 8 rounds. The most I went was 8 rounds. I never got to the point where I was up to 15 rounds. Wow. I never got to that point. And it was primarily because that gym was just so hot, especially at that time of the year. It just seemed because all of the boilers were going on at the time. And that gym was just so hot at that time. I was just never and because of the aggressive style that I had adopted going into that fight, it was just tough for me to get past 8 rounds. But of course, when I got into the actual, when I actually got into an air-conditioned Joe Louis Arena, that's right. It was no problem. It was no problem at all. So when I got to the 8th round, of course, in the actual fight, you know, I still had plenty of gas left.
Did you spar with Tommy?
Oh, a lot, right?
Yeah, I did. I did spar with Tommy. And
let me ask you the big quick, because I used to screw around with him all the time, and he almost hit me one night by mistake. And Lord God forbid. Was he as tough as he appeared to be all the time?
Oh, my goodness. Come on. Look at his
record. No. Listen, he had a lot of fights. He's a great guy. I had so much fun with him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, there's no doubt about it. He's got that big right hand. You know, right. He's a big puncher. There's no question about that. I got to the point where I could at least, you know, try to stay away from a lot of those big right hands, you know, because, you know, I'd gotten used to it a lot, used to seeing them coming, not used to taking them, but used to seeing them coming. But one of the things that, you know, people don't give Tommy credit for or don't really see is the fact that he is a tremendous body puncher. You know, Tommy, a lot of people that Tommy knocked out, he knocked them out after he had caught him with a good left hook to the body.
Yeah.
Catches him with a good left hook to the body. It relaxes the person. And then he hits him with that hard right hand. You know, and he does. He just sets that up so extremely well. And there again, that's where you got to give credit to Emmanuel Stewart. Emmanuel was just, you know, he was well beyond any other coach that I've ever worked with. I mean, in terms of knowledge, he was well beyond any other coach that I've ever worked with. He really was. He was just an amazing individual.
I got a story here. By the way, some other champions, Jimmy Paul, Dwayne Thomas, I didn't mention them. But so you had Mickey Goodwin, who was a great kid, the late Mickey Goodwin. He died at 50, I think, of a heart attack. Very, very sad. Mickey was not really that talented in his career. Emmanuel took him as far as he could take him. I remember cringing because we saw down the road that Tommy Hearns was going to someday fight Marvin Hagler. And on some card, I don't know whether you were on it or not, he was going to have Mickey Goodwin fight Marvin Hagler. We all said, oh no, please don't do that. So Mickey fortunately got hurt. Instead, they put in another cronk guy named William Caveman Lee, a very politically incorrect
Caveman
name, by the way.
Lee.
Caveman Lee. And so I remember watching that. It was in 82 on TV and thinking, can Caveman last the first round? And of course the answer was no. But Emmanuel had great influence. I mean, how else could Caveman Lee have gotten in the ring with Marvin Hagler? So Emmanuel was able to do things, put his fighters in positions because of what he did with all of you. So he was able to move the chess pieces around.
Yep, you are absolutely right, Eli. I'm glad you brought that up because he really was. He was very good in positioning us to get those championship fights. And the way Emmanuel did that, he didn't do that by just sitting here in Detroit. He really did. He had to do a lot. He had to do a lot of traveling, extensive traveling, you know, internationally, you know, and of course, locally, I mean, in the United States. He just had to do a lot of traveling, a lot of meeting with a lot of different people, promoters. You know, he also had to meet with the WBA, WBC, you know, who were the rating bodies at that time. He just spent a lot of time on boxing in general.
There were also terrible. I want to make, since we're talking about Caveman Denny, I want to make up some terrible stories out of Kronk, because there were those as well.
Oh, yes.
The death of Stevie McCrory. I had always heard of AIDS. Mickey Goodwin, Eli just mentioned. And Caveman Lee, unfortunately, when his Juwan Johnson and Caveman Lee, when his career ended, robbed a bank. And the teller put one of those smoke bombs in the bag of money. So here's Caveman driving down I-75 in Detroit with smoke coming out of the rear of his car. The police didn't have any difficulty finding him, did they?
I tell you, you know, that threw me for a loop. That threw me for a huge loop. And the reason why I say that is because if you knew Caveman Lee, it was just so far from his nature. It really was. That really was a surprise to me. There are some fighters that I've worked with, you know, you could kind of see it coming. But Caveman Lee, that really did. That threw me for a huge loop. That was just not his nature at all.
In one of your fights, in the first round of one of your fights, you kneeled down at the start of the first round. And is this true that the referee, the judge, called it a knockdown when you knelt down to say a prayer or whatever you were doing?
No, that was actually a knockdown.
Really?
Was it the second round of
Well, that was actually in the Espana fight. I'm gonna tell you, I didn't know where that punch came from until I actually watched the film. That is really the absolute truth. But I ducked. One of the things going into the fight, I knew he was a big puncher. I knew he threw a lot of left hooks. I knew he threw a lot of overhand rights. So I knew it was important for me to keep my chin in, you know, and stay low, you know. So that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to make sure every time he threw a punch that I kind of stayed low. Well, that particular time, I think I went a little too low. And he actually came up with an uppercut, and I ducked right into that punch.
Oh, boy.
And it did. It hurt me pretty bad, but I was able to get up, of course, and of course, you know, you know what happened after that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk, because most careers, God, we've had people on the air here, Hilmer, and very few careers end the way you want them to. From Sam McDowell, who was broke, you know, after being a great pitcher and an alcoholic, to John Hiller complaining that Sparky Anderson wanted him to be, you know, like be a one pitcher, you know, a sidearm.
Dennis Dale McLean,
and so many end poorly. So you win the title from Espana, you defend it three times, and then you face somebody who you are heavily favored to beat, just like Espino's heavily favored to beat you, Sean O'Grady, again on national television. And that one really seemed to turn your career and your life around in the wrong way. You told years later that you didn't train well enough and that it was a huge lesson to you. You also detached your retina in that fight. Did that really turn things around? And if you'd prepared better for that fight, maybe your career might have gone in a different direction.
Well, absolutely. You know, I believe that I just, you know, I wasn't prepared for that fight the way I should have been prepared. You know, I did have a cold going in that fight, but mainly I just did not prepare for that particular fight. But one thing you have to do is you have to take your hat off to Sean O'Grady for that particular fight. I think Sean O'Grady had already had three opportunities to fight for the title.
Yeah.
And he had lost in each one of those opportunities. I think that he knew this was going to be his last opportunity. And Sean O'Grady was just in tremendous shape for that fight. He truly was. He was in tremendous fight, in tremendous shape. I had watched a lot of the films of his fight. And of course, I watched films of his fight that, you know, where he evidently wasn't as good in those particular fights. And so the Sean O'Grady that I prepared for was completely different than the Sean O'Grady that actually showed up that particular day. He was just in good condition, and he was fighting in a way that he was not going to be denied.
Hilmer, you guys got along so well. I remember covering the build up to the fight. You guys really liked each other. Doesn't that hurt you when you go into a boxing ring and you don't hate the other guy?
No, it doesn't. That never bothered me. You know, I had a lot of respect for him. You know, I knew what him and his father was trying to do. Of course, his father was his manager. I knew they were trying to get to the championship, and I knew they had been working hard at it. And I knew they had been working hard at it for a long time. And I really did. I had a lot of respect for the both of them, him and his father, and also the relationship that they had together.
You give your church an awful lot of credit for your transition. How did they help you so well?
Well, more so than that, more so than my church. You know, my church, of course, is a big part of that. But, you know, I have a strong belief in Jesus Christ. You know, I do believe that he died for my sins, you know, and I accept Jesus Christ as my personal savior. And my relationship with Jesus Christ and the Lord has carried me and made me the person that I am today.
I want to talk about my favorite Hilmer Kenty moment and my favorite fight in his career, and nobody's brought it up here yet.
What's that?
Hilmer, I think you may recall, I didn't grow up with boxing. I didn't like boxing. I didn't know anything about it until I had to cover boxing in Detroit. Saturday afternoon, Cobo Arena, coast-to-coast national TV. You fought Vilomar Fernandez.
Yes.
On ringside, and it was watching two artists. No knockdowns, no blood. It was like watching a fencing match. You two guys were so brilliant. And I think that's one of the reasons, because you did fight that way, that you're at age 60, an ex-boxer, you are 100% mentally sound.
But you forget something, and I'll let Hilmer jump in. You got a leg cramp in that fight, and you were limping around the ring. It was almost like when Ali got the liniment in his eye against Sonny Liston and had to like put him away. There was like a round. Oh no, there's no way he can continue to fight on one leg. And so tell us about that.
Yeah. You know, I knew that was going to be a tough fight. I really did. You know, I know he had gone the distance with Roberto Duran twice, you know, so I knew it was going to be a tough fight. And my whole process in that fight was, you know, Roberto Duran wasn't able to knock him out. I'm going to go in and I'm going to knock him out. And of course it's going to make me look a lot better than Roberto Duran even. But he really was. He was just really cagey. He was hard to hit, extremely hard to hit. And those leg cramps I caught in that fight, it was simply because I just was not drinking water during the rest. A lot of times I'd go back through to the rest, to the corner for rest. And Emmanuel would try to give me water, but a lot of times I wouldn't take it. And I really did. By the 15th round, I was just dehydrated, because just think about it. You know, at that particular fight, by the time I had got to that particular fight, I don't even think I had gone 15 rounds yet. You know, I think it was the first fight I had gone 15 rounds. So I had not experienced the 15th round before. And so when I got to the 13th round, that's when I actually caught the leg cramps. And I really should have. I should have been drinking water in that corner, just like my manager or my trainer had told me to.
By the way, Duran just came down with the virus. I just read it.
Duran, Jesus.
Yeah, so you're even with him now.
Wow.
Did you,
Hilbert, where is
it? You think you wasted any time when you were fighting between the amateur side and the professional side? Was there ever a time you should have gone earlier?
Oh, no question about it. And to be honest with you, you know, my amateur boxing coach, he was against professional boxing. He just, really? he frowned on professional boxing. And then actually my brother, I have a brother, another brother, Forrest Winchester, who also boxed, and some of my amateur friends, they actually turned pro and they had a fight in Columbus, Ohio. And that kind of gave me the itch to start boxing again. And that's pretty much how I got in there, because after I tried out for the Olympics, I actually tried out for the Olympics in 1976, in 72 and in 76. And I went to the Olympic training camp in both years, but just fell a little short in terms of making the actual team. And after that, I said I was going to be it. I was going to retire from boxing, no more boxing.
Right.
But then, like I said, when a lot of my friends turned pro and they fought in Columbus, Ohio, they had a fight in Columbus, Ohio, the bugs start coming back a little bit again. And then that's when
I
came back to the ring.
Here's my last question, because you brought that up. In 76, you lost the Olympic trials in the semifinals to Aaron Pryor. This is another of these incredible titans of the sport back in the 70s and 80s. Pryor, when he turned pro, is the one who took the unbeatable Alexis Arguello, one of the greatest fighters of his era. And
one of the greatest fights anybody ever saw, Pryor versus Arguello.
It destroyed him. And I remember when you were defending your title in the second time in 1980 after you won it in March, was when Tommy won the title from Pepino Cuevas on August 2nd in, I believe it was, Cobo Arena at the time. I remember seeing Pryor there. I guess my question to just go forward from that is, where is boxing now? Back then, you could build some heroes on TV. Now, anybody who's any good is just put aside on either Showtime or on pay-per-view. The sport is really, and also with MMA, seems kind of dead. Is there any life for boxing, or is it just become really a non-entity as opposed to the old days?
Well, I really do. I think, the boxers that we had back in those days, I think we've got boxers just as good now too. I think those boxers that we have now, they're just as good. I think one of the problems that we're having, where the MMA, they put the best against the best. If you watch the MMA, they really are. They're the best fighters fighting against the best fighters. A lot of times in boxing, we're not really putting the best with the best, as opposed to you're moving up in the rankings because of your record, or because you're actually good, or because you actually beat someone that's really good, you're moving up in the rankings because of your promoter or because of your manager. I just think we have to get back to the point where the best is fighting the best. And I think that's when you're going to see boxing, get back to the top again, as opposed to MMA.
Hilmer, well, do you watch the MMA?
Hang on a minute, Bob. You know what else is missing, Hilmer? Mm-hmm. The dog and pony show is missing. The Leonard, the Tommy Hitherns, all of that stuff is missing. All the players seem to be so vanilla now. You know what I mean?
Because they're hidden. You don't see them. They don't have a chance. They're not on TV is the reason.
Well, that's the nature of the industry right now. They're just not getting the promotion, nor maybe they don't deserve it.
But Hilmer was understated, too. Hilmer never said, I'm going to kick that guy's ass this weekend. Hilmer Kenty was not that kind of guy.
I just think you have to go in the ring and let your fist do the talking. I really do. Yeah. I just think that's the way to do it, and I think most people feel that way also.
I always thought, Hilmer, that you were not the stereotype tough guy boxer, not that everybody had to play the tough guy. I always thought you were more like the kid that you sit next to in chemistry class, a little more thoughtful, a little more serious. I know
what else? He's so pretty still.
So you work at a executive search firm. You've managed to have a bit of a career outside of boxing. What are some of the other things you've done and where are you now before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I do. I work for Strategic Staffing Solutions, and I really do. I always say that we're the world champions of IT staffing. We staff information technology professionals to all types of Fortune 500 companies. I would also, the main thing I'd like to do is I've been spending a lot of time, of course, on my job, but one of the things I'd like to do, and I'm hoping to do that once I retire, is get back into boxing and get back into amateur boxing. I mean, I just think there are a lot of kids in this area of Detroit. And there again, I think they still have the same talent that we had when we were coming up. They're just not given the same opportunity that we were given by Emmanuel Stewart. So I'd like to be the next Emmanuel Stewart that comes along and give a lot of those kids, you know, the opportunities that we had, because I think that's the only reason why we were able to get to a world championships is because of Emmanuel Stewart.
Helmer, I mean, most boxers want, not you, as I just said, wind up with their brain scrambled. Why would you want to push children into boxing?
Oh, Bob, come on, man.
It's the truth.
Come on, man. Go ahead.
No, I do. I think when you push children, when I would be pushing children, I wouldn't be pushing children into boxing. It would be something that they would want to do. They have to want to do that. Not only do they have to want to do that, but my emphasis would always be that you want to make sure that you have something prepared after boxing is over. You're always thinking about what you're going to do next.
And kids have headgear anyway. It's more. I'm sure you're thinking, get them off the streets, get them something to do, learn some discipline, wear some protective headgear, wear some gloves, learn about teamwork, being on a team, learn about making yourself better. I think, seriously, Bob, no, that's a good question. I understand that. But I think Hilmer's leading more in that direction.
You're just talking about amateur boxing, not pro.
Yes, Hilmer, well, that's what he's talking about.
Right. Well, I understand that. But the kids eventually are going to want to turn pro. And Denny jumped all over me before I had a chance to ask you, do you watch the MMA? And what do you think of those guys? Talk about lack of protection.
Right. Yeah, MMA, that really is. That's not anything that I could do. I just think that's a very tough sport. And your chances of coming out of that sport with your head intact is pretty tough. And I noticed that if you look at those MMA fighters, each and every one of them has cauliflower ears. I mean,
that's from the wrestling. Yeah. The
So that, you know, that's a tough sport. I don't say anything bad about it. I really do. I take my hat off to those guys because I think they really do have to be tough.
I think it's illegal. I really do. I think there's two guys out there trying to kill each other.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, it's tough enough trying to watch a guy's hands. A guy's got two hands. It's tough enough trying to watch his left hand and his right hand. But in MMA, you have to watch his hands, his feet, his knees, his elbows,
shoulders, his head.
His own head. So that's not something I could do. Let's put it like that.
Well, Hilmer, what you did really, really well. And you've been a great, loyal Detroiter since you came from Columbus. Man. I hope you get to fulfill your dreams to help them give some kids some focus in their lives. And thanks for joining us today. Great talking to you again.
Oh, thanks for talking to you guys, too.
Hilmer, you were always a gentleman, a great interview. And on behalf of all the media people who covered you, we really appreciated you.
Remember, you take care of yourself and never forget, keep the ball down. You hear?
All right.
keep your hands up and the ball down.
That's right.
All right. Cool.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Take care, buddy. Great talking to Hilmer Kenty, and thank you all for joining us today. We'll see you again on the next edition of No Filter Sports. That would be coming up on Monday, July 6th, and we're going to talk to kind of a fringe player, but a really great guy, a proud former Tiger, head of the Tiger Alumni Association, Scott Lucader, who had a couple of amazing weeks in baseball.
Well, he's also told people he's a very entertaining guy.
He's very entertaining.
He's
very
funny. So don't just say, oh, I'm not going to listen to Scott
Lucader. One of my best friends in the business, and trust me, he played for Sparky. Yeah. He was there for a lot of stuff. And we're excited to talk to him on Monday. So thanks again for joining us. We'll see
Eli, can't we wish everybody, look at my shirt today.
Oh,
man.
Yes.
Happy 4th of July.
Stay safe.
Drive careful. Stay
safe. Wear your mask.
Please.